Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is it so hard to spell everything right in English? We can blame our spell check culture or take another pot shot at public school performance. But the truth is, English starts out harder to spell than many other languages, from Spanish to Finnish. As George Bernard Shaw liked to point out, if you take the GH as in cough, the O as in women, and the SH as in nation, you could conceivably spell the word fish as G-H-O-T-I. So how did all of this get so perplexing? And just who has tried and failed to simplify English orthography? Author David Woolman answers all these questions and more in his new book, Writing the Mother Tongue, From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. David, welcome to Think.
Good morning, Chris.
We should start this by explaining that while you use words to make your living and have for some time, you have a long and tortured history with trying to spell them correctly.
That's true. In a way, I have a horse in this race, I suppose. conversations about spelling and spelling irregularity. As a kid growing up, I was not a hot speller, and sometimes humiliated at the dinner table by my younger brother, who was a spelling whiz. And this was a source of some frustration. I wouldn't say it warranted psychotherapy or anything like that, but it did get me interested in the code itself, the English spelling system, and why it is so tough.
Part of the problem seems to be, literally, that we do not have enough letters in English.
Exactly. That's really one of the fundamental issues. In spoken English, there are approximately 44 different sounds, and we have an alphabet, of course, with 26 letters. You can combine some to create other sounds, and we do, but not 44 of them. And then at other times, of course, we have letters doing double, triple, quadruple duty, representing different sounds. And, of course, other words are peppered with silent letters or extra letters. And so this is, you know, this is really starting to, once you begin to peel away the layers a little bit, you see just how cockamamie the system really is.
And there was a time when we actually had a character all of its own for the th sound.
Exactly. And with Old English, we had, there were maybe four or six letters back then that we don't have now. And one of the other interesting elements of that period in the history of English is no one really had a notion of this idea of correct or incorrect spelling. Back before printing and before dictionaries, people were really just trying to write out words in a way that would be easiest for the reader to grasp, to sound out. And so in that sense, there was no language authority. Everyone was winging it. And as a consequence, scholars who look back at the language see 5, 10, sometimes 15 different spellings for a word like fish or church or wife or night. And it's only later, once the spelling system starts to settle down and we get dictionaries and we get this ethic of correctness, that the spelling code sort of locks into place and then, of course, starts to torment people who are not such hot spellers like me.
Were there sort of regional traditions in the way things were spelled if people were corresponding with each other in sort of a limited area?
Well, in fact, back in the days of Old English, you had these monks in monasteries throughout England. And really, from village to village, monastery to monastery, the English they were producing was quite variable. And again, because without the digital age or television or other media to sort of make the language a little bit more uniform, you're getting this kind of organic kind of language growth and dialect and variable words and words maybe that one village has borrowed from the Scandinavian, but another village uses a Celtic word for the same thing. And so that's where you begin to see that, you know, English from its very earliest days is much more this mutt, this goulash of different languages and different parts of words.
It's very interesting that in the beginning part of the and toward the middle of the second millennium, there were several languages of importance in the region that now speaks English. We had Latin from the church, French from the Normans, and of course English was the language of the common people. But then it turns out the plague had no respect for authority.
Exactly. So one of my goals in this book was to trace the roots of the spelling code. You know, how did our words come to look the way they do now? Because the spelling was never handed down to us on stone tablets. And once you start to look closely at that history, you see all of this turmoil. And the period that you're referring to, sort of the 13th, 14th, 15th century. Once after the Norman invasion, the French come over, they take over what is now Britain. English was really subjugated and pushed to the peripheries. You had French as the language of power and the courts and prestige and cuisine. You have Latin remaining as the language of God and the church. And then English, instead of being stamped out, kind of quietly persisted in the countryside, in the back alleys of London, in the taverns. And while doing so, it quietly gathered up thousands and thousands of French words. And so once the Norman occupation ends and England sort of returns to prominence, the language is now 20,000 words stronger because it has been able to incorporate so much of this French vocabulary. The plague is interesting because one of the factors that accelerated the return of English was the plague, because it really was most catastrophic in densely populated urban areas where maybe more French speakers lived. And it was these English language speakers out in the countryside who might have been able to survive a little bit more.
Why did the invention of the printing press basically set the standard for spelling?
Well, it was never an organized effort per se, but really as a sort of unspoken agreement among printers out of an effort to improve efficiency and the economy of their operations. It really suited their interests not to have such variable spellings and not to have 15 different ways to spell out a word like fish or night or church. And so the printers would kind of settle on one or two different spellings. It definitely wasn't overnight, and as I said, it wasn't organized by anyone in particular. But those earliest printers, and in many ways the anonymous characters who were actually operating the printing presses and setting the type, they were encoding what later became our standard spellings. And one interesting example with that is the word ghost. You know, why do we have an H in the word ghost? And the reason is probably because the very earliest printing presses were operated by Dutchmen, and they weren't even native English speakers to begin with, and they were seeing in the English text that they were printing that there were often would be a silent E on the end of a word, for example, and then at other times there would be an extra letter, maybe two L's in travel, for traveler, for example. And so these guys, their charge was really to come up with a nice, tidy margin on the left and right side of the page. And so they had this habit of adding on an extra E if it meant a clean margin, or lopping off an E. And with the H in ghost, that's because the G sound is represented by a GH in Dutch language. And so they just kind of plunked an H into ghost. And there was also an H in girl and in geese. For a while there, those H's were later evicted, I guess. But the H in ghost kind of lingers, and it's interesting to me because now, you know, we have these in our minds, we have these very clear notions of what is right and wrong with a word as far as how it's spelled on the page, and yet when you look at the history of a word like that, you see that wow, it's rather arbitrary how it ended up this way.
And it's amazing to think back to that time, because as things were being typeset for the first time, these typesetters were very often working with handwritten notes and documents, and then they would actually translate them by setting the type.
Right, and they're certainly not paid for accuracy or spelling. You know, these guys were paid based on the speed at which they produced printed pages. Some of them were putting out, you know, pressing as fast as 6 pages a minute, and it's almost like this industrial environment in a pre-industrial age, especially in the Low Countries, what is now Belgium. In one of the places I went to report the book is in Antwerp. It's this really famous printing museum, and you see the old presses in there, and you can just imagine the pressure, let alone the fact that when you set the type, you spell the words backwards so that it comes out forwards on the printed page. So you have non-native speakers you have non-English speakers setting the type. It looks backwards when they do so. And there's all this pressure to come up with a clean margin. I mean, spelling is like number 12 on their priority list, if it's even on the list at all.
And that's how we lost the thing called the thorn that made the TH sound.
Exactly, exactly. And then finally ended up with what we have today, the 26 letters.
And people stopped writing the way they had been writing, not because they were told to do so at that point, but because everything that was printed seemed more official, and people assumed that must be correct.
Right. And if you think about our modern day attitudes toward words and toward the printed word, I think it's a similar phenomenon. There's just this kind of official nature to words that are printed versus written out in manuscript, which after all means to write out by hand. And so I think you're right. It becomes this sort of official status, and then of course before long you see the earliest grammar guides and spelling guides that were kind of tied to etiquette and behavior guides for sort of high society people. And then soon after that, we have the emergence of the first dictionaries.
Yeah, did Samuel Johnson care about spelling?
He did. Samuel Johnson, who did not write the first dictionary, as some people think, but he certainly wrote the first blockbuster dictionary. And Johnson, he saw that the English orthography, the English spelling code, was a total mess. He knew that. When he started out with the dictionary project, he said, I'm going to fix this once and for all. I'm going to iron out all these problems. And he revealed a lot of sort of naivete about how messy the system already was. And then when you fast forward 7 or 8 years and he's nearing the end of this colossal endeavor, he admits that there's no way to please everyone. There's no way to write the system completely consistently, completely phonetically, and he really was just doing his best to find sort of lowest common denominator spellings. And yet even a guy like Johnson has these quirky tastes that he reveals. For example, he thought no English word should ever end in a C. So music and public and critic, all of these words in Johnson's dictionary end with a CK. And even though people in his time period were not writing it that way, and within 20 or 30 years, new texts are coming out that sort of toss out Johnson's idea of the K at belonging at the end of a word. But you start to see that it's much more of a taste-driven process than it is kind of a clear science of spelling.
It's fascinating to think that he wasn't content to simply document what was out there. He really wanted to have a permanent effect on the way we wrote.
I know. It's this kind of admirable sense of what a single person can do, and yet also this kind of dreamy, quixotic, like, are you kidding me? No, you can't just tell the rest of us how to wield the English language.
How did Johnson make decisions, David, about what was right? When he didn't have a distinct opinion, would he go to multiple sources to find? Back then, things were spelled in a lot of different ways and accepted that way.
He did, and that's why Johnson's dictionary was such a masterpiece, because earlier dictionaries before that, they had sort of 2,000 or 3,000 words that were primarily difficult words, showing people kind of how to bolster their vocabulary as if you were training for, like, business school interviews or something like that. And Johnson's dictionary, he sets out to define everything. That means put and thee and go and hat and all these words that seem so simple, but in fact, in Johnson's dictionaries can have 20, 30, 40 different entries. And he was the first person really to look to outside quotations to augment his definitions. And of course, Shakespeare paramount among them. Those are the people who are helping Johnson figure out just exactly what is the meaning of a word, and then also what's maybe the best spelling that I should put in the dictionary.
We'll talk about Shakespeare in a moment, because he certainly took great liberty, not just with spelling, but with words themselves. David Wolman is my guest. His new book is called Writing, that's with an R, Writing the Mother Tongue, From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. We'll return in a moment and would love to have you join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author David Woolman is my guest. His new book is called Writing the Mother Tongue, From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. If you want to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org, and we will not correct your spelling on the air, so don't worry. We were talking a minute ago about Samuel Johnson, who was a great fan of William Shakespeare, arguably sort of made Shakespeare the famous author that he is today and writer. Shakespeare himself was not so much bothered by spelling or even not a word not existing that he thought ought to exist.
It's true. And for me, there's an interesting contrast, because when you talk about language change, whether it's 200 years ago or especially today with text messaging and the digital age, we can get to that later. But one of the gripes that you often hear from people who are uncomfortable with language change is that we are drifting from the language of Shakespeare and further from the language of Chaucer, for example. And when you look back in history, Shakespeare, in fact, was incredibly playful with the language of his day in moving it away from the language of Chaucer. And likewise, Chaucer, with the English of his era, Chaucer was so experimental with new words and grafted words and parts of French words. And so you see that it's sort of this false dichotomy between English's permanence and the fact that it's always moving and shifting. And when Shakespeare was writing, he wasn't really what I call sort of one of the inner family of spelling reformers through history, primarily because the spelling code had mostly settled by the time he was writing and the printing press had come about. There was still some variation, book with an E on the end or without an E, or had with two D's or one D. You see that kind of thing. But for the most part, Shakespeare isn't necessarily a spelling reformer. But what you see with him is really this kind of pyrotechnic playfulness. He's coining thousands of new words. He's coining 5, 10, 15,000 new meanings for existing words. And by even just partaking in some of the spelling variation, even within one play, for example, he's writing book one way on one page and then book another way on another page. He's showing that, you know, there are bigger fish to fry out there than sort of keeping your spelling in a nice, tidy order. Or maybe the thinking was that some copy editor would get to that later, you know, his charge. And I sort of admire this, is, hey, look, let's write compelling, interesting sentences and paragraphs and pages. Let's not get too hung up on the tidy order of letters in each and every word.
This whole idea of spelling reform is so interesting. And Noah Webster, who, of course, was our most famous American lexicographer, certainly of his time, is fascinating because he really was a reformer and wanted to simplify things and actively worked to change the way we spell things.
So Webster is really one of my heroes in this book. And I should say that the title, Writing the Mother Tongue, R-I-G-H-T, you know, this comes from the idea sort of to right the ship. No one had ever really synthesized before this centuries-old story of spelling reformers, people who really believed that the English spelling code was so far out of whack and so unnecessarily tough on young kids trying to acquire fluency that we should do something about it. We should simplify the system. You know, my book is not sort of a thesis in defense of that position, but I wanted to explore this idea and the arguments behind it, and were they valid, or where might they have been valid, and why weren't the campaigns really successful? Because they, in fact, included some really famous people, not just Johnson and Webster, who I'll get to in a second, but then we move on to the likes of Melville Dewey and Andrew Carnegie and President Teddy Roosevelt and more. All of these really powerful people wanted to simplify the English spelling system and yet didn't get very far. The one real exception to that, I think, is Webster. And what's interesting about his story is that when he was a younger man in his mid-20s, it's about 1800, and then the relatively newly independent United States, in Webster's eye, he was worried that we were still too culturally connected to the British. That is, independence is fine and good start, but he was uncomfortable that we still had this sort of cultural umbilicus connecting us to Britain. And so his idea, and likewise the idea of some of his contemporaries, especially Benjamin Franklin, the idea was to have an American culture, we need a uniquely American language. And as a younger man, Webster had these really radical ideas about how to do that, and simplified spelling was really top among them. You know, he wanted to spell is, I-Z. He wanted to spell tough, T-U-F. He wanted to spell soup, S-O-O-P. And there's this long list of spelling renovations that Webster suggested. He published this much shorter dictionary, and it was a total flop, largely because of all of his nutty ideas about spelling. When you fast forward about 25 years or so, it looks like America is probably more confident in its shoes now. A lot of Webster's detractors are now dead, and he's kind of in his, I think he's sort of late 50s when he comes out, of course, with his masterpiece dictionary, and it's about 1828, I think, is the year. And by this point, Webster has kind of come to grips with the idea that maybe it's okay if we speak the same language as the British, and his dictionary, for the most part, he kind of dialed back these radical ideas of spelling reform. And yet, they're still there. There's some 300, 400, 500 words that we spell differently in American English than they do in British English, largely because of Webster. This is why the British spell valor or color with a U, and we don't. This is why we spell theater with an E-R ending, whereas the Brits spell it R-E. And Webster dropped an L out of the word traveler is another example. So in a way, he's kind of, in my view, he's really one of history's one and only successful spelling reformers.
It's so interesting because a lot of times people who, Americans who use those British spellings are thought to be, you know, putting on a sort of affectation. But in a lot of ways, it was Webster who affected these changes.
Exactly. I mean, it's affectation depending on where you sit. Should it be a bank check with ending in a CK, which is probably what Samuel Johnson would have liked, or should it be ending with a QUE like they do in Britain and like they do in Canada? I mean, poor Canada is kind of stuck halfway between British spellings and American spellings with this thing. And so, you start to see that underneath this seemingly simple thing, the spelling code, oh, of course, there's only one way to spell things. Just look it up in the dictionary. In fact, not only are there so many variable spellings out there, but the way the words came to take their current form, you know, is this sort of wild ride, and often includes some outlandish decisions by individuals who were just who had the gumption to think that they single-handedly could alter the lexicon.
So you talk about a wild ride. We have Teddy Roosevelt, who could charge up San Juan Hill without looking back, but could not get the American people to simplify the way they spelled things, regardless of a really valiant effort out of the gate.
The turn of the 20th century, I think, is really the heyday in the spelling reform movement. You have Roosevelt again. You have Carnegie funding this effort led by Melville Dewey, the famous librarian, who at one point, you know, Dewey, this is a guy who changed the spelling of his last name to D-U-I. And he had to change it back when his employer at Columbia University said, you know, stop that silliness. but nevertheless, you know, you have Mark Twain, George Bernard Shaw, as you had mentioned, and not long before them you had the likes of Charles Darwin. You have a member of the Supreme Court at the time. So there is this movement. You know, it's hard to know how many people outside of this effort, you know, gave it the time of day. And yet some very powerful people, especially Carnegie with the Bucks, are in favor of this.
Spent $25,000 a year in supporting this effort.
Exactly, for a number of years. And, you know, one has to wonder, he was so committed to education, of course, which is why later he gave upwards of $300 million of dollars in his day to build libraries across the country. And in the book, you know, I did want to explore the question, at least briefly, you know, what if Carnegie had given that kind of money to spelling reform, or even just a few extra zeros to Melville Dewey's office of the Simplified Spelling Board on Madison Avenue in New York? You know, what might have happened? And anyway, because he didn't, you know, the thing didn't move very far. But one of the real cruxes, I think, in this story is when President Teddy Roosevelt, who was, again, interested in this idea, he ordered the government printing office in 1906, I think it was, to start using 300 novel spellings as determined by Dewey and his pals on the simplified spelling board. So this would be lept, L-E-P-T, or rhyme, R-I-M-E. Hiccup, they wanted to change from hiccough, which is kind of the way it was spelled back then would read today, sort of hiccough, into hiccup the way we spell it now. So actually some of these spellings just evolved naturally. But anyway, Roosevelt orders the government printing office to make this orthographic adjustment, and there is an immediate backlash from Congress and especially from our allies abroad. The British were irate about this idea that the American president could muck with the English spelling code. And Roosevelt pretty quickly had to put his tail between his legs and retract the whole thing. And I sort of think it's an interesting, if not quietly amusing anecdote about presidents overstepping executive powers. But I didn't want to sort of hit the point too hard in my book. I just wanted to mention it's hard. I mean, it's hard not to. It's sort of staring you right in the face.
Well, and we can laugh about it now, but there were just furious editorials volleyed from one paper to the next. People were arguing about this in a pretty public way.
I know. It really hurt Roosevelt's reputation for a while, especially in Britain. They called him an anarchist. They said, how dare these Americans, these savages who barely have a country of their own, let alone a culture, parentheses, maybe this guy Wordsworth is writing something we would call poetry, but otherwise you folks have nothing on us. And this Roosevelt guy, he's crazy to be doing this to our language. And the British were angry, but I think once Roosevelt calmed down a little and identified that maybe this is not terrain that a president should be pioneering, it looks like the world kind of calmed down about it eventually, because he did go on to win the Nobel Peace Prize for helping to broker peace between the Japanese and the Russians who had recently been at war.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. David Wolman is my guest. His book is called Writing the Mother Tongue, From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. We have an email from Curtis who asks about the mispronunciation of the word nuclear as nuclear. Is that an example, do you think, of changing public use, or is it a mispronunciation of the word?
Well, it's such a loaded example.
Especially here in Texas.
I love this example. It's really both. A lot. There are millions of people out there who are going to insist that that is just wrong. And one of the reasons this has been such a fun book for me is because stuff like this ignites such incredible emotional responses from people. People have a real emotional connection to language and their perceived view of what is right and wrong about it. On the other hand, nuclear versus nuclear is now an alternate pronunciation in the Oxford English Dictionary as of 2003, I think. And here you have an example of usage by someone very influential, influencing the language in a kind of strategic strike kind of way. And what I mean by that is, when it comes to the verb to Google, for example, lexicographers who put together our most revered dictionaries, they're watching a word like that for a while to see if it has staying power, and they're trying to see it surfacing in various media before they really think, okay, this looks permanent enough, let's encode it in the dictionary. On the other hand, you can see these episodes in history where they're sort of in a short time span, because a very famous person used the new word or used a word in a certain way, or because of a major current event, the word rapidly enters the lexicon. Nuclear is case in point. Another more sober example would be AIDS from the mid-80s, entered the dictionary quite quickly. And yes, you're absolutely right. These are examples of language moving and changing, and dictionary editors will be the first to tell you that you cannot get your arms completely around the thing that is the English language. They're just doing their best guess at it in the pages and in the online pages of their dictionaries. But it's such a gargantuan and marvelous beast that there's no way to get the whole thing down.
Is it true that rocket scientists need spell check too?
Well, one thing I wanted to do with this book was not only look back at the history of spelling and how words came to acquire their current form, but also take stock of the language today and, of course, address where it's going, because in the digital age, it's hard not to talk about language. And so as someone who has depended on spell check so much, I really wanted to learn more about where this tool comes from. And so in doing some reporting on the subject, it turns out that indeed some of the people behind it were rocket scientists. These are electrical engineers, especially a guy named Les Ernest, who is a retired professor of artificial intelligence at Stanford. He was at MIT. He was later working with the military on programs that were really the predecessors to what later became the Star Wars program. And Ernest is really the first person in the early 60s. He put together this electronic word list that essentially became the first ever spelling checker. What's also interesting about spell check is that here is this kind of running in the background, never think about it component of our digital lives. And yet when you learn more about how it works and how hard it is to make it work just right, you see that it connects to one of the biggest puzzles in all of science, which is to teach a computer to think like a human. And this is why spell check, you know, it's hard for spell check to know that weather should be with an H, or as in whether or not, or weather like the weather outside. And that's just one quick example, but we all see this kind of thing when spell check flags something we don't want it to flag. And so I like these kind of ideas, that something seemingly simple and straightforward right under your nose is actually much more complicated than you realize.
It's fun to think about what the people at Google are learning about the way people really spell. And you can argue that some of the mistakes are typos, but a lot of them really reflect the way people spell before they've had spell check.
Right. And also reflect the way that the language is changing. When I went to visit Google headquarters in Mountain View, California, one programmer there, he had this beautiful sentence. I thought he said to me, you know, nobody in the world knows how to spell Dalmatian, so neither do we. And he's talking about the T-I-A ending, which you'll see in dictionaries, versus the T-I-O-N.
Which is basically how everybody thinks it's spelled.
Exactly.
We'll talk more about Google in a minute with David Woolman. His new book is called Writing the Mother Tongue. That's with an R, Writing the Mother Tongue. From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment, and would love to have you join us on the phone. 1-800-933-5372 is the number.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author David Woolman is my guest. His new book is called Writing the Mother Tongue, From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. We were talking before the break about Google, and this is not an organization with a particular axe to grind about the way the language should be. In fact, sometimes you can spell something correctly, but if enough other people have spelled it wrong, it will still say, did you mean, and will give you the technically incorrect spelling of a word.
Right, which raises the question, well, what is wrong, and says who? Which really, the Internet is changing all that. And before I get to it, though, Chris, I have to ask you, K-R-Y-S, are you going to tell us a little bit about the spelling of your name? I mean, I know proper nouns generally get a lot more leeway when it comes to spelling creativity, but is there a backstory to this cool spelling for your name?
I've never been asked this before. There is a backstory, and it's sort of a one that reflects how silly I was at 17. My legal name was spelled with an I. I was born K-R-I-S, and I went to college, and my RA had written it incorrectly on my door, you know, when they make you a little sign for your dorm. And it was sort of a joke at first, and everybody, but a lot of people thought that was how it was spelled. So if they would leave me a note, they would write K-R-Y-S. And I just got so used to it. At first, I wrote that way as a joke, and then I got used to it. And now it's been such a long time, sadly, since that freshman year in college that I can't imagine it any other way.
I'm impressed. It, maybe I'm going to start spelling my name David with a Y.
David with a Y. Trust me, it's not worth it because people just, I get called cries a lot when I order something.
I know. It's funny. You know, people think I have such radical tastes about spelling reform after writing this book, and I have to quickly tell them, look, I'm not a spelling anarchist. You know, I actually have some, what I think are pretty conservative tastes about language. You know, when I hear someone say, between you and I, instead of between you and me, you know, I sort of bristle a little bit. And yet now, after doing this project, I do see that there's, you know, there's some gray area between what is and isn't correct. And some of that is sort of a taste and judging people thing. And some of that is, okay, well, that's not standard English. We need to clean that up.
But you have sort of a funny story in there of fervently hoping, as a lifelong, not particularly gifted speller, fervently hoping that you would be diagnosed with dyslexia.
Right. So in one of the chapters of the book, I actually went to a center in California and subjected myself to this battery of tests to see if I was dyslexic or what some people call compensated dyslexic, which I'm not sure exactly what that means. I have a suspicion it's sort of a diagnosis of convenience to explain away my non-valedictory status. But but nevertheless, I did want to go learn more about this and more generally as far as informing the book. You know, what's going on inside the brain when we are spelling or trying to spell a difficult-to-spell word? And likewise, what's happening in the brain of someone who really has dyslexia, and sort of all joking aside, when someone has a real deficit, what's the hang-up? Where is the wiring sort of askew? And this really helped me learn more, not just, of course, about like how the brain works, but you know where spelling and where language fits into all of that. Because if you look at a language like Italian or Spanish or German or Finnish, these are very consistent languages as far as a phonetic look to them. So almost invariably, what you see is what you get, with letters on the page corresponding to what they sound like. English has thousands and thousands of words like that. Upwards of 85% of the lexicon does follow pretty straightforward spelling rules. Which might be a surprise to some people after listening to me kind of lightheartedly gripe about the English spelling code for 45 minutes. But this is the good news. A lot of the code is consistent. On the other hand, 15% of the English language is a huge amount of words, and those words are irregularly spelled. And what happens with the brain is when you're trying to write a word like yacht, the mind essentially rifles through a Rolodex up there to retrieve the card that has a picture of the word yacht written correctly. And of course it's tied it's tied at the molecular level, I guess, to the definition, to a picture of a big boat maybe. Somewhere, and then of course to the pronunciation also of what that sounds more like Y-O-T. Anyways, long story short, somewhere in that wiring, in that trio of connections, there's a mix-up for people who are suffering from dyslexia. And so that means that at a cocktail party, they can talk about yachts. Maybe they are yacht enthusiasts. They know it means a big boat. They know how to pronounce it. But when it comes to retrieving that picture of the word correctly spelled, there's a hang-up. And so anyway, as far as subjecting myself to all of this testing, it turned out I am not dyslexic, even though I spelled words like cacophony incorrectly on the spelling test that they gave me. You know, they're looking, not surprisingly, at not only at sort of percentiles and overall numbers in your testing, but then they're also looking for clues like, did you scribble the word in the margin a few times to quote-unquote see which might be the correct one? Or when you're taking a spelling test, do you look up at the sky like or the ceiling like the kids in the Scripps National Spelling Bee? That's really a tool for visualizing, because that means you're trying to retrieve a picture of the word, whereas people who have dyslexia, many of them, they have a lot of trouble with this visualization.
See, I think you did a great job of describing some of this in the book. I almost can't use a word verbally without picturing it in my head. I can't fully describe it, but they sort of are always there, and I'm not comfortable speaking a word that I don't know how to spell. But you describe yourself as being not dyslexic, but sort of on the other side of that. When you come upon something new, you don't instantly memorize it, and it just looks like a pile of letters for you at first until you've gone through and decoded it.
Right. There's this kind of gobbledygook element. I think in the book, the way I put it was that, you know, very long new words to me sort of look like a cross between HTML code and the word Schadenfreude. And this just, you know, it's like someone who has a great backhand in tennis. Maybe they're just gifted. They're just really good at this. And of course, the kids in the Scripps National Spelling Bee, they are phenomenal at this. And I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I'm not at the far end as far as like a real deficit. But I'm just not such a hot speller. And like many things, whether it's a backhand in tennis or learning to ski or to dance, with practice you can get better. If I cared enough about correct spellings, I would come up with sort of mnemonic tricks for remembering a spelling like cacophony or indictment or accommodation, renaissance and recommendation and camaraderie and all these words that kind of always trip me up a little bit. If I cared enough, you know, I would come up with ways to remember them permanently. But we live in the spell check age, and personally, I think spell check is a lot like a calculator. It's just a tool to help us do something else. And I'd rather move on to trying to write an interesting sentence with the word hors d'oeuvres instead of spending what for me would probably be hours and hours learning how to spell it right once and for all.
I'll give you that's one of those words that should just be spelled the really simple way, O-R-D-E-R-V-E. I want to talk a little bit about texting, because
sure,
there's a lot of concern about how this is going to affect the way we spell. There are all these little shortenings. I wonder, though, if that's not a temporary phenomenon, because pretty soon every handheld device will have a full QWERTY keyboard that doesn't require you to write L8R to write later.
Well, I think you touched on something important, which is how permanent are today's input devices. There was a teenage girl at one of my book readings last month, and she mentioned to the audience that C-U-L-E was a text messaging code for the word cool. And I was totally confused by that, because my assumption is that text-coded words are always going to be shorter than words kind of where we understand in more conventional terms. And she said, well, it's the same amount of letters, but it's much easier to input C-U-L-E than it is C-O-O-L on certain types of mobile phones.
Yeah, there's not that double O that you have to wait for.
Exactly. Well, see, you're
I'm not very cool, but I have texted before.
I don't know. You just revealed some serious coolness to me. But in any case, I think your point is still a really valuable one, because whether the input device that makes C-U-L-E an easier way to input the word cool, whether that technology sticks around for 2, let alone 22 or 102 years, remains to be seen. And I think you're right with this guess that the input devices are going to be changing so fast that some of the text code we see now might just fade out, which is probably why we don't see the dictionary quite peppered with text message versions of spellings just yet. Having said that, you know, one thing I find interesting is that people, again, really cling to the English that they learned, that with this sense of permanence that maybe is overblown. And text messaging is definitely having an impact on the language. On the other hand, we have to remind ourselves that this kind of thing has been happening for ages, long before computers and the internet. When you think about ER for emergency room, or P.O. box, or scuba, for self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, or ASAP, or, you know, especially in baseball, there's RBIs and ERAs. I think what happens now, so anyway, in my view, people for some reason are okay with abbreviations like okay or other text messaging things, but they're somehow befuddled or unhappy with the present day text coding. And that, there's a little bit of inconsistency there, I think. But when you ask lexicographers and linguists about this stuff, they really see no problem with it, because the language has always been doing this sort of thing. People are always truncating and abbreviating and inventing, just like Shakespeare was so playful with the language of his day. So that linguists really don't see any problem with this. If anything, it's that young kids who are text coding kind of can speak two languages and the rest of us can spell one. And no wonder we get a little uncomfortable about that fact.
Daniel in Dallas, who calls himself a word nerd, brings up the New York Times, which he says as late as the 1970s was still fighting the simplification fight using spellings like T-H-R-U for through. That brings up an interesting point, the fact that we all understand most of the time both spellings, and we know when it's appropriate to use THRU, and most of us wouldn't throw it into a business document.
Right. I think there's this sort of unspoken agreement about what is and isn't official English. But there are exceptions to that. I think maybe 40, 60 years from now, we'll see THRU for through kind of inching toward officialdom. If you Google it right now, for example, you're not going to get a suggested spelling correction. Same with INT apostrophe L for something like international. And you're right that people won't put through in the short form on a job application letter anytime soon, because they know that the person on the other end might use language as a way to judge them and to judge their application. And like it or not, language is this sort of, crude and quick way to judge people. And I think that's okay to an extent, because you want to show that you've put a lot of care into something like a cover letter for a job. On the other hand, one of the questions that comes up in the book is, how much do we want to associate something like correct spelling with virtuous behavior? Because maybe, K-R-Y-S for Chris is not such a bad thing, let alone T-H-R-U for through, or N-I-T-E for night. Some people really bristle at that. They don't like that idea at all. And yet the language is moving and changing, especially in the digital age. If enough people are doing it, then we've taken power back from the dictionary editors and said, no, they're not the only people who get to decide what is and isn't English. It's the rest of us, all of us, the users and owners of the language. We should all get to shape it and give it our stamp. And of course, a really radical spelling idea isn't going to fly, because no one's going to understand what you're trying to write or say. But little tweaks here and there, will rhubarb ever lose the H? Maybe it will, and I'm interested to know if people think that's good or bad or really just trivial.
I don't think most people like rhubarb all that much. Hey, I have to ask you, so obviously you're very articulate. You became a writer despite some challenges with spelling. What happened to your brother, the little champion speller that would just make you crazy at the dinner table 30
years
ago?
Well, I'll be happy to report that we get along quite well nowadays, probably because he's bigger than I am now. And he is a lawyer in Chicago, and he occasionally will give a quick look over some short essays that I'm writing, because he's quite funny, and I think will add a humorous pinch to them. But he never went on to do spelling bees and things like that. But my younger brother and my older sister, they both gave me and still give me a hard time about spelling. When this book project first came along, my sister right away said, "You're writing the book about spelling, but you're terrible." But she also understood, and thankfully in the same breath, she delivered some encouragement, which is, I think she really understood the idea that someone who's not such a hot speller is in fact the perfect person to go after this topic and to chase down some answers to the question of how did the system get to be so wild, and what happened to these reform efforts.
I would have to agree. David Wolman's new book is called Writing with an R, Writing the Mother Tongue, From Old English to Email, The Tangled Story of English Spelling. David, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.